to actually look at the Bible with a fresh set of eyes. And certainly there's a lot of what we've considered today. I think most of us, we could say we are familiar with the story. But what we've actually discovered is that that level of familiarity isn't perhaps as deep as what it should be. And so I've certainly appreciated John. I'm looking forward to tonight. It's all about Jephthah's daughter. I reflect on growing up, and that was always one of those little conundrums in the scripture. Well, all's going to be revealed very, very shortly. So Jephthah's daughter, Judges 11, is where we're going to be focusing. And so we're going to read a couple of sections from Judges 11, from verses 1 to 11. Then we're going to pick up the narrative from verse 29 to the end of the chapter. And then, John, if you could come up.
Judges 11, from verse 1 to 11. Now Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty warrior, but he was the son of a prostitute. Gilead was the father of Jephthah. And Gilead's wife also bore him sons. And when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out and said to him, "You shall not have an inheritance in our father's house, for you are the son of another woman." Then Jephthah fled from his brothers and lived in the land of Tob. And worthless fellows collected around Jephthah and went out with him. After a time, the Ammonites made war against Israel. And when the Ammonites made war against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to bring Jephthah from the land of Tob. And they said to Jephthah, "Come and be our leader, that we may fight against the Ammonites." But Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, "Did you not hate me and drive me out of my father's house? Why have you now come to me when you are in distress?" And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, "That is why we have turned to you now, that you may go out with us and fight against the Ammonites and be our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, "If you bring me home again to fight against the Ammonites and the Lord gives them over to me, I will be your head." And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, "The Lord be witness between us if we do not do as you say." So Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and leader over them. And Jephthah spoke all his words before the Lord at Mizpah. And then on to verse 29 to the end of the chapter. Then the Spirit of the Lord was upon Jephthah, and he passed through Gilead and Manasseh and passed on to Mizpah of Gilead. And from Mizpah of Gilead he passed on to the Ammonites. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, "If you give the Ammonites into my hand, then whatever comes out from the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering." So Jephthah crossed over to the Ammonites to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hand, and he struck them from Aroer to the neighbourhood of Minnith, 20 cities, and as far as Abel-Kerumim, with a great blow. So the Ammonites were subdued before the people of Israel. Then Jephthah came to his home at Mizpah. And behold, his daughter came out to meet him with tambourines and with dancers. She was his only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. And as soon as he saw her, he said, "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you have become the cause of great trouble to me, for I have opened my mouth to the Lord, and I cannot take back my vow." And she said to him, "My father, you have opened your mouth to the Lord. Do to me according to what has gone out of your mouth, now that the Lord has avenged you on your enemies, on the Ammonites." So she said to her father, "Let this thing be done for me. Leave me alone 2 months, that I may go up and down on the mountains and weep for my virginity, I and my companions." So he said, "Go." Then he sent her away for 2 months, and she departed, she and her companions, and wept for her virginity in the mountains. And at the end of 2 months, she returned to her father, who did with her according to his vow that he had made. She had never known a man, and it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went year by year to lament the daughter of Jephthah, the Gileadite, 4 days in a year.
Well, good evening, everyone. Have everyone survived the day and still got a little bit of energy left? Raise your hand if you've already fallen asleep. Gotcha. Oh, I've caught one. Now, this might not work, but I've had the privilege to come to Australia for the last 15 or 16 years. It's been a wonderful thing, and here we are. The devoted daughter, Jephthah's daughter's story. There's a serious problem with this passage, and that is that on a surface read, Jephthah appears to have made a vow to God that he would destroy whatever came out of the door of his house, and in fact the language is such that it's going to be a human, or at least risks being a human, for those who think maybe he was hoping an animal would run out, and his daughter was what came out, and so you have the possibility that Jephthah has actually executed or sacrificed, killed his own daughter, and the Bible bears clear testimony in the New Testament that God very strongly approves of Jephthah. So the questions that we get, and unsurprisingly, for those who are not a fan of the God of the Old Testament, for people who say, well, I would never be religious because, you know, I've heard of Bible stories, this is often quoted as one of the reasons why I could never embrace the God of the Bible, or at least of the Old Testament, because of this going on. Is Jephthah participating in human sacrifice, we ask? And if so, how can Jephthah be acceptable to God? And we also want to ask the related question, well, if not, if for some reason we'd like to believe Jephthah's daughter lived, well then what actually did happen to her? And, more importantly, what is this story actually all about? If it's not about a man setting his daughter on fire and killing her, well, it's certainly not a story about a man not setting his daughter on fire and killing her, because that's a story about nothing. So what is this story actually supposed to teach us? Another very relevant question we might ask, where's God in all this? How come there's all this total chaos going on? Why is God just sitting back and watching and letting all this horror unfold the way it does? Why does God not seemingly not intervene? And finally, is any of this relevant to 21st century discipleship? Even if we end up coming up with any solution we want, so what? The biggest question is always worth asking. So what? What am I getting out of this chapter? If I ripped Judges chapter 11 out of my Bible and got rid of it, what would change? What am I actually losing? And these are all very fair questions to ask, and we're going to try and answer absolutely all of them this evening. First of all, we need to know, who is Jephthah? And we took a reading, thanks Brother Jeff for that, and that included the first 11 verses of that chapter. If you have that in front of you, and you don't need to, but if you have that in front of you, realize this, there is a clue to solving what's going on in pretty much every single one of those first 11 verses. Every little fact that's handed out ends up being critically important in understanding what's going on and what the value of this chapter actually is. Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty warrior, okay? And he's the son of the region's founder being the man Gilead, hence the Gileadite, but he's an illegitimate son. He's defective in that sense because he's born of a prostitute, as we're told from the same verse. He's not a true, real, full son like his brothers or his half-brothers. Now, he's a godly man. That's an important thing to start, and these are the verses we kind of skipped, but there's a whole list when he's talking to the king of Ammon where he basically says words to the effect of, everything that Israel's ever won, I realize that we have not won nothing through our own power. It's because our God is with us, and our God is pleased to give us victory in battle, not that we're so strong we take it for ourselves. This is a godly and humble man, and he's a man commended for his faith. And this is the quote from the New Testament, where he's named as a faithful man. all commended for their faith alongside David, Samuel, Gideon, and others. Here's the storyline that we need to pay attention to. This is Jephthah's story, and we're going to come on, obviously, as leading ladies to look at directly at the strength of his daughter. Gilead's wife also bore him sons, and when they were grown up, they drove Jephthah away. "You are not going to get any inheritance in our family," they said, "because you are not a full son. You're the son of another woman." So the fact that they're talking about dividing inheritance and the fact that these sons now have power in the household, presumably Gilead, the father, has died and they're dividing up the inheritance. And his evil half-brothers have essentially realized, hey, if we kick you out of the family, we all get a slightly bigger share because there's one less person to share the inheritance with. Sometime later, the area of Gilead is in trouble, and the Ammonites are threatening to invade. This is a war situation. And Jephthah, who's been kicked out to the land of Tob, which is bandit country, has learned to become a mighty fighter in order to stay alive in that area. And so they go to him and say, hey, now that you're a mighty warrior, could you come help us with the invasion of the Ammonites? And unsurprisingly, he says, wow, you've got a cheek, haven't you? You kicked me out of my own family, put me into a land where my life was at risk and I could have easily died, and now you want my help? And this is sometime later. That's kind of relevant. He now has a daughter who we'll realize is approximately teenaged. That's how much later we're talking. So we're talking about 20 years later. So approximately 20 years later, his brothers come to him for help. Jephthah is still mad. Jephthah is still angry. He is still nurturing bitterness against his brothers, kind of understandably because they kicked him out of house and home, but he's nurtured this bitterness now for 20 years. So he says, okay, I'll help you on condition, and I've got a great condition for you. I will be your king. I will be your head, he says. And the elders of Gilead said, okay, fine, you will be head over all of us who live in Gilead. And Jephthah says, wait, that's not really good enough. Will I really be? I mean, you just said that. Why should I trust you? I can't trust you. And so the elders of Gilead reply with an oath. The Lord, Yahweh is our witness, they say. We will certainly do as you say. And Jephthah says, not good enough. Still not good enough. Why don't you come all the way to Mizpah and swear those words before the Lord in Mizpah? So Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and commander over them, and he repeated all those words before the Lord in Mizpah. And if you know your history of Mizpah, Mizpah's origin is a place where two people make a contract together where neither can trust the other. The whole point of the pile of stones between Jacob and Laban was essentially saying, I can't trust you as far as I can throw you, so let's make a contract together, and this pile of stone should be witness that God is watching both of us to make sure we do as we say. So Jephthah gets to be, if I win, if God gives me the victory, says Jephthah, I'll be in charge of you, and I can make you do whatever I want. And they agree. And they agree with an oath before the Lord. Jephthah insists on total control of Gilead's people. And we ask why. Sounds like he's a proud and power-hungry kind of guy, maybe an evil man. But we know he's not. We can see he has great humility. These are the verses we were talking about, and I'm not going to read them all out, but these are the verses where he keeps saying, it is God who gives victory, not me. Israel didn't take the land of Moab. The Lord gave it to us. Suppose you take me back to fight the Ammonites, and the Lord allows me victory. It is the Lord who's driven out the Amorites before his people. What right have you to take this land? Let the Lord, the judge, decide the dispute this day between Israel and Ammon. Jephthah is a humble man. His desire for power and control over the people of Gilead is clearly not from pride. Here's the evidence. But it is important. He needs power over them if he's to execute his plan. Question is, what is his plan? And he tells us, he says, this is the plan. And he's talking now to God. If you give the Ammonites, God, into my hands, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's. and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. And this is where things start to take a very weird turn, and we start wondering, what is going on here? We pose the question, did Jephthah intend to perform or even risk human sacrifice by fire? This supposedly godly or seemingly godly, seemingly humble man, why would he even risk such a grotesque thing? Let's be clear just how detestable to the Lord sacrifice of humans by fire is. We know that Jephthah knows his biblical history very well. He's just recited most of it to the king of Ammon. Ahaz sacrificed his son in the fire, following the detestable ways of the nations the Lord had driven out. So the biblical narrator is telling us, God finds the sacrifice of children in the fire to be, the word chosen here, detestable. Similarly, Israel sacrificed their sons and daughters in the fire, provoking the Lord to anger. The same again. They've built the high places, comments Jeremiah, to burn their sons in the fire. Something, this is God speaking, something I did not command or mention, and the text continues, nor did it even enter my mind. And that's a very powerful statement of hyperbole when God says, that didn't even come into my mind. It's a nonsense statement, and obviously everything has come into the mind of God, but God's saying, this is so repugnant to me, it's as if I could never have thought of it. And similarly, the indictment in Deuteronomy, you do all kinds of detestable things the Lord hates. They even burn their sons and daughters in the fire. And finally, the same thing, let no one sacrifice his son or daughter in the fire. Anyone who does is detestable to the Lord. Now, some of these scriptures are downstream chronologically from Jephthah, but some are not. And Jephthah knows very well the character of his God. So clearly, Jephthah should know this is detestable to God. But look at the phrases there, and I have used some color here just to show. That's the same Hebrew phrase every time, in the fire, in the flames. But when Jephthah speaks, he doesn't actually say that. He says something that sounds the same, but it's a different Hebrew phrase. What Jephthah has said is, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites, I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. You might think, well, burnt offerings are set on fire. And whilst that's true physically, there's a possibility at least, we know, it's an absolute fact, he's using a different clause as to what God finds detestable. So I think we already have reason to suppose Jephthah may be speaking metaphorically, the metaphor of a burnt offering, not the literality of setting something on fire. The evidence is on the screen in front of you. Five times we have that same phrase. Jephthah's saying something slightly different. Now, here's the really helpful thing. Can we actually prove whether or not Jephthah set his daughter on fire? The answer, happily, is yes. And there's very few things in the Bible you can actually prove. But we can actually prove that he didn't set his daughter on fire. Not just to satisfy our sensibilities that would be a really horrible thing to do, so let's hope he didn't. I'm not talking about satisfying my hope. We'll have to put up with whatever God says is true. But luckily, we can actually prove it. The proof comes from the most unlikely place. It comes from the prophecy of Ezekiel. And this is how we're going to prove this. God is speaking. He says, when you offer your gifts, the sacrifice of your sons in the fire, you continue to defile yourselves. Am I to let you inquire of me, O house of Israel? As surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, I will not let you inquire of me. Let me translate that into modern speech. If you sacrifice in your children in the fire, I will not even listen to your prayers. That's what that passage of scripture says. Satisfy yourself that that's the case. And yet Jephthah says, let the Lord the judge decide the dispute this day between the Israelites and the Ammonites. That was Jephthah's prayer to the Lord. And as a result of the prayer, then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. Do we see what's happening here? God listens to Jephthah's prayer and responds favorably. So if it's true that God won't listen to the prayers of anyone who sacrifices their children in the fire, and God did listen to Jephthah's prayer and respond so favorably he even sent his own spirit upon Jephthah, clearly Jephthah could never have been even threatening to set anyone on fire. This proves Jephthah was never going to burn anyone. So it continues to be a contentious issue in our community. Did Jephthah sacrifice his daughter, yes or no? And some say yes and some say no. By the time you get to Ezekiel 20, we can prove this. If Jephthah even intended to risk it, God wouldn't have listened to his prayer. And he did. So that's very helpful. We can say with full confidence, Jephthah did not set his daughter on fire. He didn't even intend to. He did not kill her by fire. Well, that's okay. Now that we've learned what he doesn't mean, we're still left thinking, well, what does he mean? What sort of weird idiom is he saying when I say I'm going to sacrifice someone as a burnt offering? Let's look into what burnt offerings are about. So we go back to the law and we say, what are the characteristics of a burnt offering? If the offering is a burnt offering, there is three factors. It's generally a free will offering, and the other specifics are, he is to offer a male without defect, and the priest is to burn all of it on the altar. So the characteristics of a burnt offering, it's generally a free will offering, it's not forced, it's something you choose to give to God. That fits with what Jephthah said. The subject has to be a male without defect. So Jephthah certainly wasn't going to offer anything that could have been female. And the entire animal was utilized. That's the sole unique characteristic of a burnt offering. It's given in some way wholly, whilst every other offering and sacrifice, only parts of the animal were used. So somehow we have to reason, Jephthah planned to give a male without defect to the Lord wholly, i.e. forever. And some of you might already be putting together now exactly what's going on. And this has happened before. This has happened another time in the Bible. It's in the case of Hannah. And what I want you to realize is Hannah offers Samuel as a burnt offering. The reason Hannah has never formed this big contentious issue is she doesn't use that phrase. But look at how she offers Samuel to the Lord. Hannah wept much and prayed to the Lord, and she made a vow, as Jephthah did, saying, O Lord Almighty, if you will only look upon your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life. So Hannah's sacrifice of Samuel was a free will offering. This was Hannah's idea. She didn't have to do this. It was a male without defect being, well, he's given at a very young age, so he's not a man of routine sin. I mean, he can't be perfect, he's human. And he's given for all the days of his life. Hannah's offering is a free will offering of a male without defect given wholly for life into temple service. This is her sacrifice of Samuel as a burnt offering, metaphorically speaking, because it matches the characteristics of a burnt offering. Hannah never used the phrase burnt offering and didn't confuse millions of Christians for thousands of years thereafter, which was handy. So Jephthah could take a note there, but hey, we're here to sort these things out, so that's all good. Hannah is offering her firstborn son for lifelong temple service. So now we're beginning to solve what Jephthah's up to. Let's see what happens. Let's look at the result. When Jephthah returned to his home in Mizpah, who should be coming out to meet him but his daughter, dancing to the sound of tambourines? She was his only child. So when he saw her, he was distraught. He tore his clothes and cried, Oh, my daughter, you've made me miserable and wretched because I've made a vow to the Lord that I cannot break. Now, the first question that has to come to your mind is, how can he possibly expect his daughter not to be the first one out of the door of the house. He's got one child and one child only. Of course she's going to be the first one out the door of his house. What has gone wrong in his brain that he didn't even think this was a possibility? Well, it's over to you. That's the hard part. You can do the hard part now. What's the answer? That's right. She's not a male, but she's the first one out the door of the house. Oh, he just wasn't thinking. Yeah. Sorry. Because I'm male, I didn't get it either. Straight over the top. Yeah, because the answer's staring us in the face on the screen. Potentially, so we don't ever hear about her, so she may well be out of the picture. But I mean, I'm sure he wouldn't have wanted to lose his wife either. I mean, I don't know. I mean, certain marital arrangements, you tell me.
He's in Mizpah.
When Jephthah returned to his home in Mizpah. Jephthah doesn't live in Mizpah. He lives in Tob. It says so at the beginning of the chapter. Jephthah and his daughter live in Tob, which is about 2 to 3, depending on speed, 2 to 3 days' journey away. Jephthah's daughter is safely tucked up in bed in Tob, so thinks Jephthah. It's not possible that Jephthah's daughter can come out of the door of any particular home in Mizpah. Now, that may have solved one problem, but it's created the other one. If Jephthah's home is in Tob, is the Bible wrong when it says when Jephthah returned to his home in Mizpah? What is this, a sort of vacation home, or what's going on here? Sorry? Perfect. It's his family home. The only two homes you can say, if I'm going home, I'm going to California. But many's the time I say I'll go home to England, because that's where my parents still live. He's gone to his parents' home. And we know who lives, his dad's dead, so we know who's going to come barreling out the door of the parents' house. One of his brothers. Which one? Guess what? He doesn't care. He hates all of them. He'll let God choose. Sure, send me any brother. Show me which one you've got, God. Because he's playing a tricky thing, God says, oh, you want to play like that? I'll show you which brother I'm sending you. And unbelievably, he's targeting one of his brothers, but who should come out of a house that she should never have even been in? His daughter. That's why he's so surprised. She shouldn't have been there. Wrong house. Okay, well, we've solved lots of questions. We've still got questions left. Fair enough. Why was she in the house in Mizpah? What is she doing in the family home from which she presumably may never have even seen? And not be in the house in Tob where she was supposed to be safe. Is it a cunning plan by the brothers? Have they found out about the plot and deliberately pulled the daughter in and sent her out the door of the house? Almost certainly not, because then Jephthah would feel rage. I mean, he's already mad at his brother for 20 years. If they've tricked him further and destroyed his family line, he would be infuriated. So that can't be the reason. And here's a very sensible suggestion, I put it to you. It's her idea. She isn't consumed by bitterness. Her father has gone off as the absolute hero to her, that he doubtless is, to fight for God and for God's country and for God's people against this wicked invader. How awesome would it be if she leads a full family celebration of his return? It's her fantastic surprise to him that when he comes back to the family home in Mizpah, she will lead the celebrations. And not only that, she probably knows that Dad is mad at his brothers. He's probably moaned and whined about them at the dinner table 500 times over 20 years. It would heal the family rift. What a great idea to mend the fractured family. But Jephthah's ruined it with his vow. And she comes out with timbrels, with a tambourine, to lead the celebration of God's wartime victory. Of whom does that remind you? Absolutely. Miriam. This is a leading lady. She too knows her scriptures. Miriam led the celebration. Miriam, the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took a tambourine in her hand, and all the women followed her with tambourines and dancing. This is the same scriptures that Jephthah knows so well and has doubtless instilled in his only child. And this is what she's copying. What an excruciating irony that she has this wonderful godly plan and it's all going to be destroyed because of her father's stupid plan. Let's just recap everything we've got so far to make sure it all makes sense. Compiling the evidence, and this is all from the Bible, we're not making this up. Jephthah's a godly man, we see that. The fact that his prayer is answered by God proves he was not intending human sacrifice. We saw that from Ezekiel 20. But, and here's the biggest but, he had been embittered against his brothers for, quote, some time, long enough to have produced a teenage daughter, so probably about 2 decades at least. He's been mad at his brothers. He can't forgive them for the way they wronged him. Therefore, he says, here's a great idea. If I come back from victorious, I must have total authority in Gilead. Why? Because who is the leader in Gilead? Now that Dad's dead, his brothers are in command of Gilead. So he has to make sure, and if he comes back home and says, you go to temple service, they're just going to say, ha, forget you, right? So he makes them swear an oath before God that if he comes back victorious, he will have power over his brothers to direct them however he wants. So he vowed to devote a male without defect from his family home in Mizpah to the Lord. Why is it so ironic that the sacrifice must be a male without defect? I'm sorry? Well, you speak for yourself there. You see, that's the irony, isn't it? Why was he thrown out of home? Because he was defective by a bunch of men who didn't consider themselves defective. So his brothers are males without defect in their eyes. So he's happy to come home and say, well, you know, I'd sacrifice myself, but we all know I'm defective. So what about one of you males without defect? You're the perfect ones. It's perfect. It's clever. It's everything works. But God does not respect that kind of behavior. And therefore, he vows to offer one of them as a burnt offering. Nothing to do with fire, i.e. a male without defect to be given to the Lord forever. He is planning vengeance, 20-year-old vengeance against one of his brothers by sending one into lifelong temple service. This is the solution, therefore, to what is happening in Judges chapter 11. And here's where Jephthah's daughter steps up and takes the lead. Rather than just, since she's unmarried, and yet clearly old enough to speak as an adult, almost certainly a teenager, and yet hardly this is hardly the voice of a teenager, this is a voice almost of a patient mother with an errant child. And yet she's speaking to her own father. My father, she replied, you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me just as you promised, now that the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the Ammonites. But grant me this one request, 2 months to roam the hills and weep with my friends because I will never marry. And you see there's a hint even in her language that she knows she's not going to be killed because otherwise she'd mourn the loss of her life, not just the loss of her opportunity to be married, which she'll lose by being in service at the temple. She mourns her virginity, not her death. And that's how you can basically figure out how old she is. She gives a very mature response. These aren't the words of a six-year-old, yet she's unmarried. And in that culture, that's not going to be true for very long. So she's probably about a teenage. Okay, so again, this is good. We've solved what Judges 11 isn't about. It isn't about anyone being set on fire. What is it about? What is the point of this chapter? And I think when we can see the point, we'll realize why it's one of the five most relevant problems that we still have to this day, that you have in your life, that I have in mine, and that you have in your ecclesias, and that I have in mine. What was Jephthah's problem? We've seen he's a humble man when he speaks about God. I take your point. I like the idea of vengeance. I put it this way. He could not let go of a grudge. Someone had wronged him. And fair shout, they really had wronged him. He had been wronged. But he was never, ever, ever going to let it go. Now think about it. Now, as you don't have to participate in this if you don't want to, but if you think you've ever been a victim of someone bearing a grudge against you, just raise a little hand. That's how relevant it is. That's how relevant Judges 11 is. I saw approximately almost getting on for about a double-figure number of hands. This is, and if you ever think, whoever thinks they might have been guilty of being the grudge bearer, raise your hand. I love it. There's always less hands go up. We know when grudges are held against us, but it's, I saw about 7 or 8 hands. So isn't that one of the most relevant things we have? This chapter is about, this is how bad grudge bearing can get. This is a beautiful scenario where God has total victory of everything and the whole matter is destroyed and polluted because one man who otherwise is an extremely godly man in every way, he just had one little massive flaw. He was a grudge bearer, and it ruined everything. Because that led to taking revenge, as James said, vengeance, and pretending it's service to God. Oh, I'm going to create a system. How can God object to my plan? I'm going to put a man into temple service. What a pure gift to God. It could hardly be less pure for the reason why he did it. And God says in the law, as you know, don't bring me broken animals and impure offerings. I don't want that. Show me some respect. He says that in Malachi as well. And that's what Jephthah's done wrong. Jephthah says, here, Lord, here's my brother to serve you forever. And God's like, yeah, right, that's why you gave him to me, isn't it? You gave him to me because you wanted me to have an extra temple servant? No, you've just killed off his lineage forevermore because you're mad at him and you've been mad for 20 years. I don't respect that. I won't respect your vow, Jephthah. In fact, I will confound it. You want to offer me something sincere, something valuable? I'll make you offer me something valuable. I'll make you offer me something so valuable you won't want to give it to me. And he didn't. And it's a very sad story in that sense. This is where Jephthah, somewhat like Judah, finally comes around to do a good thing. He at least keeps his promises. And in keeping his promises, he earns his place. We earn nothing by God, you understand what I mean. But he earns his place in the Lord's sanctuary. Lord, who may dwell in your sanctuary, says David? Who may live on your holy hill? He whose walk is blameless and who keeps his oath even when it hurts. So lesson number one, keep your promises. Jephthah got that. Lesson number two, don't bear grudges. That's what Judges 11 is doing in your Bible. It's the chapter that says, do not bear grudges. They can be disastrous on a scale you wouldn't believe. Unfortunately, one clause, a burnt offering, has distracted thousands of people for hundreds of years. But the lesson is there, and it's powerful, and it's ever so important. Keep gifts to God sincere. That's what we're learning here. Let's back up, since we've finished in the detail, let's just back up, though, and look at the big picture. Men rule selfishly. We've seen this in the case of widows with the life of Tamar, and we see it here. Jephthah's father was Gilead. His mother was a prostitute. Why was his mother a prostitute? His mother was a prostitute because Gilead was a selfish and self-indulgent man. He had a wife, but he decided a prostitute would be kind of fun to be with as well. And therefore he had legitimate children and illegitimate children. That's just selfishness. So the root cause of this tragic sequence was an abuse of power from the father, Gilead. So let's think. The father indulged himself selfishly. His child paid the price. Where have we seen that before? In what we've just been looking at. Whatever comes out of the house, I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering to the Lord. But we know what he means now. Jephthah sought power in Gilead in order to exact personal revenge, not to glorify God. His child paid the price. Both times you have a human father who abuses power for his own self-indulgence. Both times it's the child who paid the price. Both times a family is broken up as a result. Which still leaves us with our remaining question. Where's God in all this? God is just watching this happen. Jephthah devotes his teenage daughter to the Lord, and Hannah, we saw as a co-example, also devoted her young son Samuel to the Lord, which is kind of a little bit tough on Samuel. He wasn't even part of that decision. The time between the two events is hard to establish. I haven't quoted a source for that information because there's a few different timelines I look at, and they don't all say the same thing. But the average suggests that these events are about 30 years apart, that Hannah has devoted her young son Samuel to the Lord about 30 or 3 or 4 decades after Jephthah has devoted his teenage daughter to the Lord. Where is God in all this? God is building families, as any good father would. Well, that's a nice phrase to throw out there. But where's the evidence that God is doing anything? The evidence is here. Samuel grew up to respect the Lord. The boy Samuel continued to grow in stature and in favor with the Lord and with men. Well, of course he did. He had Eli as a father. No, not possible. We're told it's not due to Eli, the high priest, being his surrogate father. Eli's sons were wicked men. They had no regard for the Lord. And whilst you can't put the sins of the son onto the father, you can in Eli's case, because the Bible says we can, because the Bible says it was Eli's fault. Well then, if Samuel grew up to be a God-fearing man, you have to ask, who was living at the temple to act as a godly parent to raise the infant Samuel? Jephthah's daughter. You kind of feel, I suspect, that they met on day one that he arrived. Think, Jephthah's daughter has been there for 2 or 3 decades, about 3 decades. So from a teenager, she's now coming up to somewhere north or south of 50 years old. You kind of suspect that Jephthah's daughter maintained her faith in God and she prayed for a child. And she must have realized as the years ticked by and she prayed for a child and prayed for a child and prayed for a child, that the window of opportunity through her own body closed. God says no, or so it seems. And then one day, there's a young child at the temple in need of a mother, and a mother who has spent so long being in need of a child. God provides a mother for the orphaned boy and a long-awaited child for our leading lady. And what a child we have. It's Samuel, Israel's last and arguably greatest judge. And this is what God is doing. And guess how he's doing it? Because he's working with a leading lady as always. It's oh so quietly. We read Judges 11 and the only thing on our mind is, well, did he set her on fire or not? And we argue and start throwing chairs at each other and eventually everyone goes home. That's not the story. The story's much quieter. Selfish men have broken families. And God has taken the fragments and pieced them back together in a wonderful and powerful way. And I find that beautiful.